This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. More than 23,000 elementary and middle school students are back in their classrooms in Boston today. And on Wednesday, the state will require all middle schools to reopen for full-time in-person learning unless they've been granted a waiver. So what does that mean and how's it going? Here with the rundown is WBUR Edify reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Let's start close to home in Boston. As we said, about 23,000 students indicated they'd be returning back to their classrooms full time. What portion of the district does that represent, Carrie?
Yeah, so while that does sound like a big number on its surface, Boston Public Schools is a pretty huge district. So 23,000 students is actually only about half of the student body there, just over half anyway. I should also note about that number that it could change as the year continues. There were some families that didn't opt in specifically for a learning model, so they were automatically placed into one of the learning models that they might have previously selected in the year. So there could be some wiggle room as the weeks progress and people figure out where they've been placed.
And Carrie, this is K through 8 students for the Boston Public Schools?
This is K through 8. Yeah, it depends with this district because they are trying to phase out their middle schools. And so some elementary schools went K to 8. There are middle schools in some senses. And so the district just went full K to 8 in this sense.
And how have they been getting ready to do this safely?
Yeah, ventilation is one of the big factors in this sort of safety preparation part of reopening. It's one of the things that the district's been working hard on all year. I know it was one of the most, one of the biggest areas of concern when it came to a lot of union concerns. You know, most of the classrooms in the district's older buildings now have these standalone ventilation units that will be circulating air. There are quite a few older buildings in this district. So that was a big deal that those came in. There's also this masking policy that they and most of the rest of the state have. Custodial staff, I know, have been installing extra hand sanitizing stations around schools. That's been happening for a little while now. And there is also a very strict visitors policy. They're letting very, very few visitors, if any, inside the school buildings. Also, on a sort of side note, too, I've heard from other teachers who have told me that if they can work it out logistically, they're going to be trying to hold more classes outside, too. So that'll be happening.
All right. So now I know there are some other school districts like Somerville bringing elementary and middle school students back today. The state deadline is Wednesday, as I understand it, for middle schools to reopen for in-person learning full time. How many students around the state does that affect?
Yeah, it's hard to get an exact number on this because, like I mentioned before, with some of the Boston public schools, that some go to, you know, K through 6 or 7, you know, they might not have a specific middle school. And so it depends. They might get lumped into like one building opening versus the other. But what I can tell you is that according to state data, that there are about 213,000 students enrolled in grades 6 through 8. And as far as the high school date, that is next in line, we don't have a specific date for that yet. But from what I've heard from a lot of different districts, they are using this first day back from April vacation as this target reopening. I know I spoke with a family from Holliston, for example, who told me that, you know, their 10th grade son will be going back, or he went back today. So, as a rule, we don't have one yet from state policymakers, but we are seeing high school students starting to return full-time in person, especially this week.
So as these plans were all being crafted, there was a lot of push and pull with teachers' unions. They were worried about educators' safety. Do school districts and the unions appear to be in agreement at this stage about reopening plans?
I mean, that's a hard one to answer because, you know, there has been, like you said, a lot of push and pull all year. There doesn't seem to be too many big disagreements, I guess, at this point. And it should be worth noting, like, you know, there have been some school systems in the state that have been working really smoothly with their unions throughout the year, that it's been pretty amicable, as reopening has been rolled out in various different stages. Others have had more contentious relationships. But so far, from what I, you know, have been hearing, there haven't been too many big issues pop up in most recent days. I think it also really does help that more teachers have been vaccinated, and the governor did set aside at least a couple of days for specifically for educators to get vaccinated. So that is also easing some of the tensions there.
So I want to switch gears. There have been a couple of other big equity in education stories. I'd like to touch on them both, and we'll start with Boston's exam schools, where a federal court recently upheld a temporary admissions policy for them that allocates most seats by grade and zip code rather than relying on test scores, and it's for next academic year. We know that a group of white and Asian American parents are appealing that decision, saying the policy would seek to favor Black and Latinx students. So with that in place, what happens now?
I mean, I think the simple answer here is that the district finally gets to tell students who have applied to these schools if they were admitted or not. That was something that was actually holding up the admissions process. The district was kind of waiting on what the judge was going to rule before they released their decisions. I think in previous year, the district had, been releasing these decisions beforehand, but from what I've heard, they've been telling parents who've been calling in to ask about application status that this ruling was something that they had to wait for before they'd be sending those out in the mail. And also, like you had mentioned, this policy is really only for this year. This ruling is only for this year. And that's because, they had been planning on having this admissions test. They had a new a vendor for the admissions test, and then because of COVID and the social distancing precautions, students weren't able to take that exam this year. And that's been something that has been a huge factor in this exam school admissions for years. So if any bigger changes happen, it would obviously take a larger conversation. But for now, we at least know what the process is going to be for admissions this spring, leading into next school year for those exam schools.
Carrie, just briefly, less than 6 months ago, an appeals court found in Harvard University's favor in a legal battle over equity in its admissions. That's the college level, I know. It's only two cases, but does the education community see a pattern emerging here? Are you hearing that?
Well, I mean, these are two very different cases. Boston Public Schools doesn't consider student essays when deciding who to admit, kind of like Harvard University does have those, college admissions essays that they do weigh in their admissions. But, I mean, there are some similarities that are coming out. Like watching the court proceedings for the BPS exam school case, a lot of the plaintiffs were trying to make the argument that saying that the district was trying to consider race too heavily, and that by using zip code, that was too heavy of a racial weight there. The judge in the end didn't agree and said that this does pass constitutional muster, even though it is not perfect. I mean, also another similarity that has popped up here is that the judge has sort of highlighted that, again, while these admissions policies aren't perfect, that there isn't racial animus involved, that there is at least good intention, and that they aren't finding that there is a racial, like, quota system or a racial balancing system going on.
Okay, I also want to talk about our vocational schools, high schools throughout the state. The Commonwealth has preliminarily passed a regulation that would allow individual high schools to determine admission criteria, eliminating a blanket requirement that the schools had to factor in things like grade, disciplinary records, other information. The new approach, of course, every high school would still have to follow state and federal guidelines, but this is a lot more flexibility. Why? Why are they doing this and what's at stake?
Well, I mean, I think what you alluded to earlier was equity is a big concern here. This policy proposal was something that people have been advocating for at least the last couple of years. At least the last couple of years, the Vocational Education Justice Coalition, I know, is one of the big groups involved with that. And the big argument behind that the coalition and others have been saying is that a lot of districts, or in a lot of districts, the student bodies who were enrolling at these voc tech schools weren't really reflecting the general student body district-wide. And actually, later, a state analysis did end up backing up that claim. It found that only about 60% of applicants of color got slots to these voc tech schools, compared to 73% of white applicants. And for the coalition and a lot of students who were upset about this, the admissions criteria that schools were using and that the state had been relying on was playing a pretty big role in this pattern, especially when it came to the consideration of things like disciplinary records. And that's because, several studies and analyses over the years have shown that students of color are disciplined at higher rates than white students. And that's something that students themselves have brought up in public meetings discussing this policy in recent months. Aya Faiz, who is a 10th grader in Chelsea, she's actually one of the more recent examples of this that I've noticed. At this month's Board of Elementary and Secondary Education meeting, she told board members about her experience getting suspended for cussing in class. And she said that a lot of her white peers often got away with that, or at least received lighter punishments. And so here's how she says that relates to the current admission policies.
Given that the vocational admissions policy is based off of these expectations, we are literally being set up for failure when this policy chooses us based on these aspects. If we want our students of color to succeed, this policy needs to change.
Yeah, so right now, this policy or these admissions policy proposals are open to public comment. Nothing has happened yet, but an official vote will be taken in June.
All right, that is Carrie Young, senior education reporter for WBUR's Edify. Carrie, really helpful. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For many of us, a good walk outdoors has been one of those newly found pandemic hobbies meant to help us wind down and safely engage with the outside world. So whether you've been walking around the block or taking long hikes, call, tell us about it. How has walking helped you appreciate your community or nature in a different way during this pandemic? What are your favorite paths, your favorite neighborhoods? Have you had moments where you've felt unsafe, where you've had to adapt, or are there places you feel like you can't go? And if you've been walking more, do you think you'll keep doing it as we find our way to some new normal? Let's talk about it. Call us at 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. We have two experienced walkers to have this conversation with us today. First, we have Alex Cox. This last Saturday, Alex completed a huge milestone. Over the course of the last 4 years, he walked or biked through all of Greater Boston, nearly 2,300 miles total. In case you're wondering, that's about the same as the length of the Mississippi River. Alex, welcome.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thanks so much for having me.
And we are also joined by Mark Hurwitz, who is an Appalachian Mountain Club hike leader. He also writes about food and the outdoors for Dig Boston. Mark, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. So, Alex, I'm going to start with you first. 2,300 miles is a lot of miles, and I understand that you did more than 90% of that on foot. Why did you decide to do it?
Well, Tishana, I had always loved walking in Boston. I mean, it is America's walking city, and there is just so much that you can see on foot. And so I had started to kind of, when I lived here or moved here, I had started to explore the neighborhoods near me. And as I started to kind of explore more and walk more streets, I started to keep track of that. And then I realized that I could actually reach the goal of walking all of Boston after a few months into the pandemic, when walking became kind of the only real safe activity that I could do in the way that I like to spend most of my time. It was my favorite leisure activity, my favorite form of exercise. And I just loved getting to go and explore the entire city on foot.
Nice. What was your biggest discovery? In 2,300 miles, I imagine you saw lots of different kinds of things. Your biggest discovery?
Oh, I mean, I loved all of the little pockets of green space that I found throughout the city. I think that probably my favorite, I can't say it's a discovery because I had been there a couple of times, but I
That's
think the
okay.
Arnold Arboretum is one of my favorite spots in the city. There's so many great little green spaces and urban wilds like Geneva Cliffs and the wilderness section of Franklin Park. So getting to find those quiet spaces was a really great find.
So, Mark Hurwitz, let's turn to you now, the Appalachian Mountain Club hike leader. So, I don't know if I'm picking a fight by asking this question. Are hiking and walking the same thing or different things in your mind?
Well, that's an interesting question because we've actually had that struggle with the name of our group. So we're within the Appalachian Mountain Club. We're AMC Local Walks and Hikes. And yeah, it's a fine line, I guess, where if you take a walk, say, to Castle Island from maybe the JFK station, yeah, that's a walk. But if you go into the Arboretum and start doing the hills, I guess you could consider that a hike. So yeah, I mean, we call them both, really. I mean, to me, it's how easy it is, how quick it is. If there's sidewalks and roads, I would tend to call them walks rather than hikes. But there's a lot of hiking in Boston and in the suburbs.
And Mark, did you find that more people wanted to both walk and hike as the pandemic wore on?
Initially, not really. You know, a lot of people at first were scared. I mean, no one knew what was going on. And a lot of people would just want to stay in. And then slowly they realized, you know, I can't do this. You know, the weather's getting nicer. This was last spring. And need to find places to go that maybe there aren't many people, but just get into the woods or go into some fields or on the ocean. And so, yeah, we saw more and more people get out for a while. But then this past winter, it seemed like a lot of people just decided not to go out.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's go to the phones. And listeners, call in. Are you walking more? Where are you walking? Are there favorite trips that you have or new discoveries you've made? Also, are you maybe someone who doesn't feel safe walking? Maybe there are places you don't feel like you can safely go. We want to have the whole conversation. 800-423-8255. We've got Kate on the line in Truro. Kate, go ahead.
Hi. I've been lucky enough to be in Truro since November. Because we lost our house in the glass fire in Napa Valley. And I just want to say how important it is to have these protected, beautiful places in our lives. And to be part of the National Seashore that I know will always be there for me has been an immense gift.
Kate, I hear a lot of emotion in your voice. This really does sound like it's very important to you.
It's a sacred spot that I've been, you know, graced with, and I just wish I could send a little bit of it to everyone listening.
Thank you, Kate. I feel like you did. I feel like Kate did send us a little bit of that. So, Alex, let's pick up on this idea that Kate just gave us of sacred spaces in walking. You know, you walked in a city. It's not going to be the quietest place always. And yet, can you find the sacred in those walks?
Absolutely. I mean, I love the city. I, you know, no offense to Mark and hikes, but I am definitely, I prefer walking in the city to walking in nature. And I did really find bliss in just kind of being able to see so many families out walking together, enjoying themselves, people sitting out in parks, getting to enjoy each other's company safely during the pandemic. That was something that really brought me a lot of joy over the last year.
Mark, I imagine that being in nature, more the hike side of what you do, maybe I'm projecting, but I'm imagining that often people will find the kind of peace or sacred space that Kate was telling us about.
Absolutely. And you can definitely find it within the Boston city limits, like Alex was saying. And, you know, once you get beyond Boston into some of the inner suburbs, even you can, if you look hard enough, you can find some places where there's nobody at all, you know, like for instance, the, Cranberry Pond in Braintree or Rag Rock in Woburn. There are these places that, nobody knows about. So it doesn't take too long to get out of downtown Boston to find some real peace.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255, to talk to us about how you've been walking or not walking during the pandemic. To join that conversation, we've got Sandra on the line in Acton. Sandra, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, I really found that walking was my only solace, like the time I felt most normal. And what I would do at first, I tried to get out around my neighborhood. And it seemed like everybody was trying to get out in the neighborhood, and then you were seeing more people than you were comfortable with walking around. So I just ended up trying to find a spot where there weren't a lot of people. And I was lucky enough to find one and would grab my friend's dog and go out there and just let him run off leash. And it was just you know, you'd forget to leave your, you know, you wouldn't want to leave your house. And so the only time I felt safe was when I would go there. But it's also, you need to decompress and get out of your house and out of your head. And that was really my survival, was being with this dog. I think the dog had a lot to do with it, but being outside was.
So why'd you borrow a dog to bring with you, Sandra?
Well, I know this. I have this friend, and she has this dog, and I'm very close to them, so I'm very comfortable with him, anyways. But it just was like he brought out joy. It was just the ultimate distraction, and so it was kind of like somebody to go with too. It wasn't just yourself, and you know you might get a little lonely because we're already so separated during this time.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Sandra. I've got one other caller who I think has brought dogs out for his walk, too. We've got Steve on the line in Watertown. Steve, how have you been walking?
Yes. I've been walking about 4 to 6 miles a day, nonstop, even before the pandemic. We landed up, my family, we actually got a second dog in December to keep on walking. And actually, the dog walking has been, it's good. It's been good for our health and for the dog socialization. But it's also been good for our socialization because you run into other dog walkers and you're outside and, the two big leashes kind of like automatically keep, social distancing everyone. So it's it's been a dog send.
A dog send. Okay, Steve, you win the line of the day. That's going to stick in my head when I'm walking my own dogs. Alex, what about this idea of companionship when we're walking? And I'll add to that. Part of the reason I asked Sandra why she borrowed the dog is, I walk my dogs a lot. I'm out walking a lot. But when I was younger, I had been taught to be very careful as a woman about walking alone and thinking about my safety. I know dogs sometimes can provide for some extra safety, too. But what are the various aspects of companionship and walking, Alex?
Yes, well, I think that most of my walks, I enjoy kind of my solitary time and getting out of the house and having some time to myself to listen to music or podcasts. But I think that walking with a companion has also been a really wonderful thing during the pandemic and kind of the only way that a lot of us have been able to see our friends in person. So I definitely identify with that.
Mark, I talked about the safety for a woman, for example, walking alone. As we were thinking about having this conversation today and all the joys of walking, we were also really thinking about the challenges of walking. And what was in the back of my mind was a conversation we had here on Radio Boston recently with an artist named Imani Willett, who wanted to retell the story of the glorified American road trip from the Black perspective, because road tripping held dangers of violence and terror for Black drivers. And, I'm thinking about this moment where we have assaults on the street of Asian American and Pacific Islanders, that community across the country. We know that Black and brown people have historically felt racially profiled and dealt with profiling in predominantly white neighborhoods. How do we create a walking culture that is safe for everyone? And how do we recognize that right now it's not? Do you think about that in your work, Mark?
Well, it's interesting because when I do lead, I mean, we haven't really led hikes much in the past year, but when we lead hikes for the Appalachian Mountain Club, a couple of things come up. First of all, it's a melting pot. It's basically like being on a subway in New York City, but with a small group hiking in the woods, and nobody really thinks about, this person is, different cultures, different religions, so we're all in it together. The other thing we do tell people, though, on the hikes is we say, don't think about, try not to go on a hike by yourself, even though you think you might be going to some park where maybe there's people walking dogs. It's not a good idea to hike alone, to walk alone. So the whole companionship thing is also a safety thing. And I think it's really important, just to, safety in numbers, really, because especially in the woods. You just don't know what can happen in the woods. So it's really important, I think, to at least when you're in a remote area, to walk with other people.
So safety in numbers, an opportunity for a cross-cultural experience in walking in a group. Anything you want to add, Alex?
Yeah, I think I I would definitely like to acknowledge my privilege as a white man who can feel safe walking alone, whether in kind of in the city or in a more kind of wooded, secluded area. I know that that's not something that everyone is able to do, but I would really like it to be something that everyone could feel safe doing. And there are lots of ways that we can do that, whether it's better street lighting at night, having just more eyes on the street that can help everyone else feel as safe as I do when I walk.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255, to tell us about your favorite walking experiences. We have Lisa on the line in Lexington. Lisa, go ahead.
Hi. I was called in to say in Lexington, throughout the last couple of years, they've been documenting where all the conservation land is, and there's quite a bit. And then they created basically these 12 hikes, paths, that's through mostly conservation, but also weaves in through some streets and stuff. And so they made the, you know, there were sort of 12 of them, and if you do them all, I think they send you a certificate. I'm not sure. But anyway, I got the map, and my husband and I started doing them in the really, you know, hard winter months where we have dogs, mm-hmm. and so we're always in the woods. But, you know, you tend to go to the same woods, you know. And it was just amazing how much joy it brought us. I mean, it was really so much fun, and, you know, we'd sort of try to do our time better, you know, because we had one of the meter things, and then we'd run into people we knew in town and talk, and then we'd say, like, oh, no, forget our time. We were trying to beat our time, and now it took so long. So anyway, it was a really funny thing, but it's just, it was interesting how much, I mean, we've always loved nature and being in the woods, but it was interesting how much happiness it brought to do this. And
I can hear
it,
Lisa.
We both so looked forward to, like, yeah, we got to go do that one again.
That's great. I can hear the happiness in your voice. I think we've got another caller who wants to talk to us about the joys of walking in a conservation area. We've got Bonnie in Eastham. Bonnie, go ahead.
Hi. I've been really enjoying the conservation land out here in Cape Cod. And one thing that really helped was to go online and type in the town names and conservation land. And you can come up with, there are maps for everywhere. And these are a lot of spaces that people don't really go to. There's a lot of tourists on Cape Cod, and they're all going to the beaches. So I've been really avoiding the beaches, even though, you know, the nice weather is out here. So going on the conservation trails and the maps, when it's nice
Wonderful.
Outside, there's not as many people.
Thanks, Bonnie. I'm going to try to grab one more here. Sophie in Cambridge. Sophie, what's on your mind?
I was thrilled to hear about this show today because I just finished walking every street in Cambridge, which
is
my
great.
Pandemic project. Thank you. And what was so special about it for me was having an intentional project that at the beginning I was just casually walking, but then like it got a little bit boring, so I kind of wanted to have like a way to structure my walks. And that was a great source of joy for me to look at my map and my spreadsheet and figure out pockets I hadn't seen yet to be intentional about it and get to know Cambridge that way.
Thank you, Sophie. So, Alex, the joy of having a real project. You know, Sophie walked all the Cambridge streets, you walked Greater Boston. Talk about the joy in having that project, that goal to work toward as you walk.
Absolutely. Sophie, I identified with that so hard. It really is just, it's such a wonderful thing to, it gave me so much joy to just have something to get me out of the house during COVID and to have a safe and real world experience that, you know, was getting away from Zoom and also being able to explore more than just the couple of blocks around my apartment that I'm used to. It's so wonderful to have a goal like that to work towards.
And Mark, I'm struck by across these calls, we hear a lot about joy. We hear about feeling safe in a time of uncertainty in the pandemic. Talk to us about the mental health benefits as well as the physical health benefits of this walking and hiking.
Well, yeah. So we've been in this for more than a year now. And when you think about it, I mean, dealing with something like this for a year, the stress, basically everyone's burned out right now. Everyone is just kind of languishing and just really fried, you know, and I think for a lot of people, they just look forward to finishing up with work for the day and going out for that walk on some side streets, or maybe finishing up on a Friday and going out, you know, looking forward to a Saturday, going hiking in the woods with friends. And I mean, it really does de-stress you so much. I know that every Saturday we map out different hikes for the AMC right now. And the minute we get into the woods or into the fields or along the ocean, within a few minutes, the stress level's just gone. So by Monday, we're already saying, oh, can't wait to do this on Saturday. So it's really important for people to do something like that. It doesn't have to be walking or hiking, but it just needs to be something where you can find a way to get rid of that stress. Because right now, I mean, the past year has been absolutely horrendous in so many ways.
Well, that's encouraging, that sense of stress, and I mean, reducing stress and getting freedom. Thanks to the listeners for calling in. You just heard Mark Hurwitz, Appalachian Mountain Club hike leader, who also writes about food in the outdoors for Dig Boston, and Alex Cox, who just walked nearly 2,300 miles as he walked or biked through all of Greater Boston. Mark and Alex, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having
me. Thank you so much.
The Boston basketball community was dealt a blow last week. We all were. Terrence Clark, a 19-year-old freshman guard who was playing for the University of Kentucky, died in a car accident on Thursday. Clark may have been a Kentucky Wildcat, but he was a Bostonian in his heart. Boston was always his home. He grew up in Dorchester, and many believed that he would go on to be the best player to ever come out of Boston. For more on the loss of Terrence Clark, we're joined now by Tony Richards, founder and director of No Books, No Ball, a nonprofit that's been helping at-risk youth in the community for 30 years. Tony worked with Terrence through the program. Tony, thank you for joining us here on Radio Boston.
Yes, thank you for having me.
I'm sorry for your loss, Tony. How are you?
Fine. Thank you again. It's a community loss. I'm just one of many that, you know, had the pleasure of touching the young man's life and being touched by his life.
I think you met Terrence when he was 8 or 9. What can you tell us about him? Who was he as a person?
You know, watching him grow up as a young man, you know, we were just fortunate enough to have an opportunity to, you know, have been able to introduce him to the game as a young man and watch him go on to, you know, bigger and greater heights with other organizations throughout the city. You know, he played on a lot of the community events that were hosted and held by a lot of mentors and, you know, guys in the basketball world, some of the people that attached itself to him to make sure that he kind of went down a correct path, you know, were very influential in his life. You know, his AAU programs. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. Go ahead and finish your thought.
A lot of AAU programs that he was affiliated with, a lot of the community, you know, individuals that soldier and labor for the love of these community youth were instrumental in his development. So I'm just one of many.
Tony, it strikes me that as I learn more about Terrence, that a whole community did raise him up because of his potential. You know, for listeners, he declared for the NBA draft for this summer. How unusual is it? How rare is it for a young person to go all the way in basketball?
I mean, it's you know, quite rare. I mean, over a 30-year period of, you know, running the No Books, No Ball program, we've, you know, come across and had encounters with thousands of kids over the city of Boston. And, you know, there's only a few kids that really break that barrier to get into the NBA that allow them to, you know, chase their dreams. I mean, the short-term goal has always been, for me, is just get academically strong enough to be able to get a college degree and save your parents some money, you know, with tuition. So, you know, the NBA dream, you know, is always a longer reach, but it is reachable. And clearly you've seen with some of the kids that have come from Boston, and Terrence was just one of the few, but really represented Boston in a very admirable way.
You told us before that he wore Boston like a badge of honor. He really loved his community and stayed deeply connected even after he went off to college and started growing as a future pro player, right?
Yeah, I mean, yes. I mean, you know, so many times, so often you see kids that, you know, come from the community, reach higher grounds of, you know, athleticism and get in different higher levels of, you know, prominence in athletics, whether or not it's football, basketball, or wherever. And they really don't represent or shine Boston like I watched Terrence do. I mean, he was one that really wore Boston and made a point to always represent Boston, where he was from, because I'm sure he's seen the same thing that I kind of seen at a younger age, where a lot of these young kids just want to feel that there's an opportunity and there's hope. And he, you know, he was an individual that gave these young kids that level of hope to make them identify that just by them being from Boston doesn't put limitations around them to be able to be recognized on a national level. So he was adamant about making sure that his performance displayed that this is what Boston develops and this is what's capable of coming out of Boston, his talent.
Our sound engineer, Marquise Neal, is a son of Dorchester as well. And at the end of the week last week, he was talking about this loss not only as tragic, but just so discouraging. And you talk about the fact that Terrence gave young kids hope. I think about that discouragement. How are the young kids in the basketball community taking it this week?
Well, you know, a lot of the kids are devastated. You know, I think more so on the fact that Terrence was a personable kid. You know, he really made himself accessible to the young kids that, you know, looked up to him in a shining light way. Again, you know, not to mention any particular kids' names, but some kids, when they get to that level of accomplishments, they distance themselves from the community and almost, you know, if though they want to not, you know, reach back and remember that they were once of that level of stardom. I like the young kids look at, you know, these upper class players like Terrence was, but he was a kid that always put himself to the ground level of the kids that looked up to him and made sure that, you know, he gave them a level of hope that you can come out of here like I did. You can accomplish some of the dreams and the levels of, you know, athleticism that I did. Stay the course, work hard. You know, he gave words of encouragement to a lot of these kids. This is how you get to this point. You work hard, you study hard in school, you know, you have to be a scholar athlete, things that we all promote as mentors around the city. He gave those kids that direct verbiage that, you know, it's almost like the level of kids listen to kids. Kids more relations. If we as adults, we can tell them the same thing 100 times, but if they hear it once from a kid of their peers, they seem to gravitate to it a little more.
Tony, before I let you go, you know, we in the media are not innocent of systemic racism. And over the years, we have often participated in focusing on stories about young Black men that are negative. Terrence was an inspiration, a young person that did everything you're supposed to do, pursued his goals, got there, brought up the young kids behind him. We tragically won't get to see what he becomes now, but how important is it to tell his story widely?
Well, you know, I've been doing this work for 30 years, and I think the biggest delivery that I can give to kids is, you know, we use his life and the impact that he had as something to model ourselves from as kids and adults. We look at the story that he tried to tell. We look at the legacy that he tried to leave. We look at the impact that he tried to have, and we continue to carry that torch. We carry the torch from people that and mentors that get passed it to us in the city, and we can't let his name go in vain. We have to continue to make sure that these younger kids remember that you have to reach back, send the elevator back down to those less fortunate that are looking to acquire the same and attain the same stardom that you maybe have been able to attain. But just don't forget where you came from, because you'll never forget where you're going.
That is Tony Richards, founder and director of No Books, No Ball, a nonprofit that's been helping at-risk youth in the community for 30 years. Tony, thank you for joining us and helping us process and understand the depth of our loss with the passing of Terrence Clark.
No, but thank you for having me. And may he continue to rest in paradise.
Listening to that conversation was our Check the Scores, Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tiziana.
So let's start, Chris, with reactions to what we heard from Tony Richards. I want to note that Terrence Clark was 19 when he died.
Yeah, I mean, this story is such a gut punch, and I was really struck by Tony's first words to you that this was a community loss and that he was just one of many folks feeling this. And I think that really sums up this story. When you look at Terrence Clark's path and kind of the way he was rising at this astronomical level, but also staying connected to where he came from and being so focused on providing the mentorship to the younger kids that he said he didn't necessarily have growing up, and trying to always stay rooted where he came from. I just think it's always tragic when you lose someone at that age, but then to have somebody that had these kind of gifts and had the work ethic and was surrounded by all these folks, the community really lifting him up as offering, hey, this is the best of us. And then to have him taken away at the age of 19, I think is just absolutely devastating.
You know, Chris, the Boston Celtics, I was interested to learn, really felt this loss deeply. Terrence Clark hadn't been drafted into the NBA yet. He didn't play for the Celtics. But I understand that there was just strong reaction from the team. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this kind of speaks to the kind of kid that he was, that he was so focused. He, you know, years ago had reached out to Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. He wanted to be a Boston Celtic someday and thought these were two young stars in a league who can really help me figure out how to keep my head on straight and how to stay focused and driven to get to the place I want to be. And so he reached out to them for advice, and they ended up kind of working out together periodically. He would, you know, play pickup with them, and they'd stay in touch. And you could hear the team talking after the game on Thursday last week. Kemba Walker was basically in tears. Even Coach Brad Stevens basically had no words to kind of sum up what the team was going through. And I got a little bit here of Jason Tatum talking to reporters about his relationship with Clark.
You know, I've been in the gym with him. He used to come to a lot of our home games. Came to my birthday dinner last year. You know, we talked a lot over the phone. You know, I wish we would have talked more, but, you know, kind of like a little brother.
For a kid who hadn't even been drafted yet, the way you're seeing players in the league react to this is it's almost like they considered him a peer already. And Jaylen Brown is one of the folks who's kind of joined this chorus, calling for the league to give the Celtics a ceremonial pick so that they can draft him and allow his family to at least have that moment.
Is that a thing, Chris? Is that something that's been done?
Yeah, it's not unprecedented. The league has done it before, yeah. And I wouldn't be surprised if it does happen, especially since he had such a strong connection to the city. And clearly the team also feels that connection as well.
So, you know, you and I check the score every couple of weeks on sports here on Radio Boston. I was struck by the fact that you just said his dream was to play for the Celtics. And our sports teams, they are inspiring. I mean, Boston, especially over the last, 20 years, has really been juggernauts in sports. They are the place our young athletes want to go. And I'm struck about the irony that in this moment of just pure heartbreak in the Boston sports world, it's actually also a promising time for Boston sports teams right now. Talk about that a little bit. Yeah. This is a strong time for our teams.
We've talked, Tiziana, throughout this pandemic about how a fun, deep playoff run for a team can really kind of bring the city together and give something for folks to feel good about and to feel this kind of sense of camaraderie and community. And you do have, the Celtics and the Bruins are basically in the home stretch of the regular season looking to gear up for the playoffs. And you even got the Red Sox coming out to a pretty decent start, which is a pleasant surprise. So there is a lot to be excited and hopeful about in the Boston sports world right now.
So we don't have much time left, but let's cherry pick that a little bit. Let's at least give us a little bit of joy with where the Celtics are and how they might go forward.
So the Celtics, this is a tough one, because if you had asked me a week or two ago, I would have said, this is great. They have turned the corner. This is finally a team that looks like they know what they need to do to win. And then yesterday they lose to the Charlotte Hornets. Not really a good team, and they trailed pretty much the entire game.
Ouch.
And it's kind of indicative of what we've seen from this team. They're right now hovering at a sixth seed, so the sixth best team in the East. And the playoffs have this kind of weird format this year where if you're a 7th, 8th, or 9th, or 10th seed, you have to basically play to get into the playoffs. So they should be playing for their lives right now, but we're still seeing this kind of lack of hustle pop up here and again. And Coach Brad Stevens actually talked about this after the game yesterday.
I said to the team at halftime, I thought we were guarding them like we were expecting to play against ourselves. Like we were going to hold it for an extra dribble instead of like, boom, boom, boom. They just flung that thing around. And give them a lot of credit today. They clearly set the tone. They were clearly the better team.
I remember last summer, Tiziana, we talked about the tourney. They got bounced from the Eastern Conference Finals by the Miami Heat, who a lot of folks thought were not as good a team as the Celtics on paper. So you'd think they'd be coming back hungry and ready to go, but so much of basketball is ball movement, as Coach Stevens just talked about there, effort on defense. You have to want it and you have to be willing to kind of go to battle with each other. And right now the Celtics have not shown that they're able to do that consistently. They seem to think they're a team that can flip the switch when it's time to flip the switch. They struggle against some of these bad teams sometimes. So we'll see as they hit the home stretch here. They're going to be fighting for their playoff seeding. And then once the playoffs start, obviously it's win or go home. So we'll see if they can come together. Yeah.
We'll watch it together. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick, who's always here to help us check the score. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Listeners, that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.